You're listening to Disturbing the Priest with Brandon Baddock.
Smoking in the boys' room was like your first 45, right?
That's kind of the one that got me lit, man. That was probably like, I don't know how old I would have been, maybe 10 years old, but I had like this little record player, like this little compact one. And I had a couple 45s, and it was that Brownsville station smoked in the boys' room. And it just sounded like, there was guitar and it sounded tough and it had attitude. So that kind of, that got me kind of involved in like, wow, there's some other kind of music out there, like rock and roll music.
Yeah. How did you, so, back in the day, you had to go to a record store, you had to buy like a 45 if you wanted to listen to a single. Was it like your parents who got that for you? Did you have like an older sibling?
I had an older sibling that was huge influence on me. And that was my sister. And she was 5 years older than me, Lori. And, she had a, she was, totally into music. So I'd always hear stuff kind of coming out of her room. So I might have nicked that off of her because like I had my own little 45, my own little 45 player, So yeah, very well could have nicked that off of her. And she had advanced to full on sort of like stereo that could play like LPs. And as I got, I'd hear stuff coming out of her room. First it was kind of like, the Osmonds, Bay City Rollers. And then she started playing stuff like, Aerosmith, Led Zeppelin, and Montrose. And I was like, whoa, what's happening in another room? And so, that's kind of where that, that was like, the magic point where I started listening to that, some of that heavier stuff, that she had.
Totally. People have it so lucky now. They really do with how easy. Like you pretty much have every song for free now on YouTube. Before it was like, wait, what's my sibling listening to? How'd they get that?
Yeah, you had to work for it, what I mean? And then you'd hear from a friend about a band and maybe they had the record. And so you'd go to the record store and you'd go buy records. And I was lucky growing up in Berkeley. In the Bay Area, because it was a pretty groovy hippie town, so there's a lot of record stores and stuff like that. So I remember like saving up my money. The first album that I ever bought with like my own money was Deep Purple Made in Japan, because it had Smoke on the Water,
Hell yeah.
And what a great album, man. It was like a double album. And I think like a regular album costs like maybe $5.99 or something. And then, and the double album was $7.99 back then. This was probably like the late, mid to late 70s.
Wow. I'm paying like $50 for a record today,
Man. Yeah. And then you get those, those 180 gram records or something like that. And they're even more. Yeah. It's amazing, man.
Single LP too, ridiculous. Now, if you didn't want to play guitar before that, that must have been the point, because that record has amazing guitar on it.
Amazing, that live guitar album.
Yeah,
it was like kind of darker stuff, I got into Deep Purple and then Rainbow and stuff like that, and UFO and those were huge bands for me. And Ritchie Blackmore's phenomenal. I mean, those guys were like seasoned players, man. I mean, it was pretty incredible. Being that sort of world at that time, and listening to it, going to sleep stoned with the headphones on or whatever.
That's amazing. So when did you start playing guitar?
I started playing guitar, I would say probably around when I was like about 13. Yeah. Something like 13, maybe 14 or so. And,
just so like 3 to 4 years after discovering kind of your early influences, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I had a close friend of mine, a childhood friend, and his father was musical. piano player. And so he had a guitar, had gotten a guitar, his father helped him get a guitar, he had a Stratocaster. And I was hanging out with him all the time, spending the night on the weekends and stuff like that. And we were buddies, getting in all kinds of trouble. But yeah, he had the guitar and he had an amplifier. And he'd be in his room playing and he started learning stuff. And I was just watching him. I just couldn't believe it, man. I mean, before I'd seen some concerts and stuff like that. And I was lucky enough that my older sister took me to see Led Zeppelin in 77. And that was an epiphany, you know, because I saw that and I was just like, you know, I'd seen Slaughter Made the Same Movie. And I said, I want to be like that, you know, but it took a few years to get there. But when my buddy was playing, it all seemed very tangible, man. It was like, he's right there playing it, you know? And then he would hand the guitar to me and I would just hit it and be like, sound would come out of it. So it was pretty cool, man. I mean, that was the point that it seemed tangible and I want a guitar, you know?
Was that Jeff?
No, Jeff Fogarty. Yeah. We were in a band together. No, it was a friend of mine before that named, Brad Zerflew, who's not with us anymore, but, yeah, he was a good friend of mine. And, interesting enough, Brad's mother knew the Fogarty family, and it was all sort of, you know, our parents were pretty young, man. We're like baby boomers, you know. So our parents, when I was like, you know, 15, my parents would have been like, you know, I don't know, like probably like their 30s or something, you know, at that point, maybe, yeah. You know. But and so they were hip to music too. So it was it's like growing up in the Bay Area, it's pretty everybody kind of knew each other, and the families were all pretty supportive of what us kids wanted to do, you know.
How'd you meet Jeff Fogarty?
Jeff Fogarty, him and I had a band. This was like at the very beginning when we were kids, and we had a band called Thrust. We thought that'd be a popular name with the ladies. And but Jeff, I had met Jeff, and that was like my first band when I was a kid was with Jeff Fogarty. And of course his dad was in Creedence Clearwater Revival, and his father and my father were friends, so they hung out when they were young, kind of out of high school. And so as you know, everybody started having families and kids. So I met Jeff at an early age when I was like pretty young, man, running around. And then we kind of separated for a while. And then his father, Tom, would still come over and see my dad once in a while. And that's when I had my guitar and I was in my room playing, listening to Led Zeppelin albums and listening to Aerosmith albums and playing along. And Tom was over one day and he said, "Hey man, yeah, you know, you're getting it. You're getting good." And he goes, you should call Jeff up, man. He's getting really good at guitar. You guys need to jam together." So me and Jeff hadn't seen each other for a while. We kind of grew apart as we got older, but, you know, older from being, you know, little kids, but, yeah, about 15, and he was probably about maybe 2 years older than me or so. And, yeah, we started our first band and, we just started doing it, man. And it was amazing. You know, we had, Luke Bowman on drums, who would later be the drummer in Ruffians, and, a bass player. And, yeah, it was just pretty amazing. We're playing UFO songs, and we're playing Scorpion songs, we're playing Def Leppard songs. And, but then we're playing stuff like, you know, we heard UFO cover this song, called All or Nothing. And we had no idea, because you didn't have the internet or anything back then. We thought, oh, that's just some unreleased song that UFO covered. We thought it was cool. And then a little bit later, a few months later, I think my sister or somebody, she was, "Oh, that's a Small Faces song." And we're all, "The Small Faces, who are they?" And then and then you go find out, you listen to Small Faces. And when you're pretty young at 15, like, it doesn't have the testosterone that you would think, but you're still kind of digging back and finding, you know, these bands that influence the bands that you like. And, you know, we listen to some Small Faces stuff at an early age. But yeah, that's what we're doing back then. And you know, that's how I met Jeff. So
amazing. I'm trying to remember if you mentioned before, did you guys have like any original songs for Thrust?
You know, right after we had the band Thrust, and then some of the personnel changed, and then we called the band Thrasher. And then we'd later find out that there's a skateboard magazine called that.
But, yeah.
But yeah, we thought it was a cool name at the time. And that band started playing original stuff. So that was like the first songs that we started writing when we were young. And I think at that point, I'm still around 15 because stuff moved fast, you know, then it was like, you know, we had Thrust and Thrasher all within the, you know, the time that I'm 15 years old. But yeah, we started writing songs, and the songs that we started writing were kind of influenced by those bands like UFO and stuff. But we had started getting into Judas Priest at that time, you know, and Iron Maiden and bands like that. So that was kind of Def Leppard. I mean, that first album we're really into. So that started influencing our writing and the direction that, you know, I wanted to go and other guys wanted to go in the band, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in terms of like original stuff, was that ever published? Did that turn into Ruffian's songs?
No, none of that. No, that was pretty, you know, just some primitive writing, I think. It was, we had probably like three or four originals along with, you know, the UFO Scorpion stuff we'd play. But what's funny enough, none of it's been published or out or on YouTube or anything, but maybe a couple years ago, Jeff had given me a CD of a party that we'd played back in like, you know, 1981 or whatever it was. And wow. He goes, yeah, man, I'm going to try to, you know, get this thing to sound good. And I listened to it, and I was like, oh man, we're not too bad for being like, you know, a bunch of kids. And there's a few songs when Jeff's dad, Tom, would jam with us. Like we'd play the party or play the, you know, wow. He'd show up. And so we would do stuff like, what do we play when he sat in with us? We'd do like Sloop John B, like, Beach Boys, or we'd do like Muddy Waters. And wow. We even did one time, I remember we played a youth group thing and we did Proud Mary with him, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah. You know, I mean, he was like, he was my friend's dad, you know? And he was my dad's friend. So it just seemed like, oh, well, he's in Creed's, he was in Creed's Clearwater, you know, this,
you know, yeah. Casually.
But he was, you know, he was very supportive, just like my father was. My father didn't play an instrument or anything, but Tom was very supportive and, hey, get up with the kids, man, and jam, you know, and let us use, like, you know, we used to play through the old Creedence Clearwater amplifiers before we got like our Marshalls and stuff. And it was those old custom blue sparkle padded amps. They were the custom brand amps, and they were so clean that you had to put like a MXR Distortion Plus in front of it, you know, get the distortion, you know. It was really cool back then, and having people that was supportive, and you know, Tom being real supportive and all that sort of stuff.
Wow. Now on that I'm curious, I have a couple of questions on that CD. Are there any of the original cuts on that? And do you remember any of them? Like, could you play any currently, or are they just erased from your memory?
No, they're completely erased from my memory. Yeah. Shit, I remember. I listened to it though, man. And the drummer was Chris Mignottis, a friend of mine, and Dan Mora played bass, and Dan Mora would be the bass player in Ruffians. And I just remember listening, like, those guys were really grooving, man, as a rhythm section. And Dan was such a great bass player. He took to playing the bass so well. He picked it up so well. I remember he had, growing up in the same neighborhood, Dan had broken his leg. So he was like kind of confined to being at his house. And he had gotten his bass before that. And I remember like going to his house, you know, like, you know, a month later or something like that. And, you know, cause he couldn't go out and hang out and play with this guy with a broken leg, but I went checked in on him, you know, and dude, he was playing Who songs. He was playing UFO songs. He played with his bass. And I go, what do you, how did you get so good? He's all, I got a broken leg, man. I sit here and play my bass all day long. And he learned that by picking up the needle, like we all did back then, like, you know, step by step, man. And you know, totally fucked up your records doing that, you know, but that's how you learn how to play music, you know?
Yeah. People have it so easy now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So easy. You had to have a stereo. You had to have the record itself, you know. But that's,
and then we got cassettes. You know, we started learning how to play off cassettes. And bang, 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 forward, backwards, and then you would take that, and then you'd hook up with your buddies, and maybe he got something out of it that you got didn't get out of it, or vice versa. And you'd show each other stuff, and yeah, it was pretty. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, and then the tape gets destroyed. Unfortunately, I collect cassettes. There's so many old ones. Like I've found like original Kill 'Em Alls and stuff, and they're just completely unlistenable. Like just destroyed. Well, hey, vinyl's still sticking in there, you know.
Yeah, vinyl's made a big resurgence. It's been a while now, you know, and yeah, it's great. A lot of stuff's getting released on vinyl. Bands are releasing stuff on vinyl more than CD sometimes these days. And it's really cool, man, because I mean, that's, you're looking at it, you're looking at the artwork, and you're opening up and you're reading all this stuff. And it's like, you know, back then it was like a mystery. You had to connect all the dots. Oh, this guy produced this record and that guy produced this record. And, you know, and there was guest people would play another people's records or something, like at the back of Pat Travers' record, you'd be like, Scott Gorham plays on this song Dedication, and oh, Scott Gorham from Thin Lizzy, you know. And
yeah,
and
yeah, you don't really get that anymore. Like, that's what's great about even like CDs kind of had that, but you're like sitting there with a magnifying glass, you know.
Yeah,
like what are they saying that verse, you know.
I can barely read the small text on the LPs anymore. Oh, it's crazy. Yeah, man. Oh. It's great, you know, and the you know, the qualities, you know, if you have a good phonograph, man, turntable, the quality of records, it sounds pretty warm. It's a different need. It's a different sound, different experience, you know.
Totally, man. Like I have a buddy who has he has Zeppelin too. He has I believe it's the RL press. It's like the Ludwig press, where it was like the first ever press, and then it was recalled because the bass was too high.
Oh.
And it's like destroyed. Because what happened was that the guy who managed the label, you know, his daughter got it and had one of those little suitcase ones, and it kept skipping because it couldn't handle the mix. So they remixed it. But that original like bassy mix is very sought after, and you can find like one that's completely destroyed and it plays perfectly.
Wow.
My friend has one, and we were cranking Zeppelin too, and it's like I heard the record for the first time.
Really?
So, that's, yeah,
wild. Yeah. I never knew that. I'm a big Zeppelin fan, so I'll have to check that out.
The RL presses. Yeah, the RL insane. Wow. Insane. So back to your timeline. So right after Thrust, you got involved with Laws Rocket. Was that
we had Thrust, Thrasher, and then Laws Rocket. I was in that band for a little bit. It was me and Aaron Jell, another guitar player, and Mike Coons. We started the band, and that was around like 19, I don't know, like late 81, maybe early 82. Yeah,
so you're a founding member of Laws Rocket.
Yeah. That was a long time ago, man. And we did that. We started writing originals right out of the gate.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you remember your time in that band? Even though it's like probably like a blip looking back at it right now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, all the, you know, it's funny because you look at it, and even though, like, you know, a year seemed like 5 years or something, you know, everything was moving so fast, and time was like, I don't know. It seemed like a year goes by fast now, but a year back then, it's like, you're doing so much within a year. So it seems like a long period of time. You know what I'm saying? Kind of.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I remember it being great. I mean, we had the manager of the band back then, you know, he was like, you know, went to high school with him, our high school friend. It's like, oh, I'll manage the band. Right. And he was like a grade above us or whatever, a couple of grades. So he was pretty, you know, in tune with some of the happenings. So, yeah, he takes us over to a place called the Old Waldorf, which in San Francisco, a club that, you know, all the national bands played and everything, and some of the cool local bands played. And we saw this band called Hans Naughty. You might have heard about from them in the Murder in the Front Row documentary. Uh-huh. They were kind of like the Van Halen kind of posery band, but Jeff had known one of the guys, I think, and he took Aaron and I over there to see him, and he's like, yeah, man, you guys want to play here? And we're watching, there's lights, PA, man, this is a place where national bands played, right? Went through and played. We're like, yeah, we want to play here. And so he's like, all right, I'll see about getting you guys a gig with these guys. So somehow he got us on a bill with like Hans Naughty.
Oh my god.
And so we're the young metal guys, like, you know, we think we're Iron Maiden, Scorpions, you know, we're playing that style of music. And then we opened up for the local kind of Van Halen band. And yeah, it was great, man. I mean, back then it was just so exciting. It seemed like anything was possible. And we started playing shows there. They were called Metal Mondays. And the people thought, oh, we'll give the metal kids the Monday night, we'll see how it does. And man, the local kids started coming to those shows, and next thing you know, they're doing Metal Mondays on weekends.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah, wow,
it was really cool. And that's the first time I met the guys in Metallica. The manager, Lost Rocket manager at the time, he had connected with them. I think they'd sent him the demo. And so they came up and played, and we did a show at the Old Waldorf with them, and they'd played before us, right? You know, because we were kind of been playing there already, and we're the local guys, and they're coming up from LA. And I remember seeing their sound check, and I was just like, whoa, man, like, what's going on here? Those guys, I hadn't seen a band, you know, play that fast with that many time signatures. I hadn't seen a local band do that, really, they weren't local yet, but you know, they would soon become to be.
yeah. definitely. Wow. So right after Laz Rocket, you went on to form Ruffians. Was this a reaction to your departure? Or were you like, I'm just gonna make my own thing? Was it a natural thing?
Well, I was replaced in that band by another guitar player. And then I said, okay, I'm going to do my own thing now and start a band. And that was Ruffians. And that was when was that? I don't know. We probably formed that band, started playing around, because I was in Lost Rocket maybe for a year or so. So that was probably around 83, maybe early 83.
I think the first demo is 82.
Is it 82? Okay.
Yeah, I can fact check all this right now.
Yeah, I think it's 83. The first verse demo we
formed
did.
In 82.
Okay. So I think you're looking at the internet though.
Yeah. you're I feel like you're a more reliable source.
The band formed in 83. We did our first demo in 83, and we did our first show. I think it was the latter part of 83 at the Mabuhay Gardens. So So Ruffians, we started that band, and I started that band with Luke Bowman, who was in the previous bands with me that I talked about when we were kids, and another guitar player called Chris Hutchison. He was another guitar player, and he'd played with Luke in a band called Heretic during the time that I was playing in Laz Rocket. And so the three of us hooked up and started writing songs And it was in the drummer's basement of his house, right? His mom was kind enough to let us practice down there, right? So we'd run off from school, come home from high school, go practice at his place at like, you know, 3 o'clock till like 5:30, till his mom couldn't take it anymore. And then we'd all break off to go home and go, you know, eat dinner. But yeah, so, and then we needed a bass player. So we grabbed Dan Mora, who I had previously played with the bands that I talked about earlier, the Winter Kids. And then we had the nucleus of the band, man. We had four guys, and then we needed a singer, and we just started auditioning singers. We auditioned, I don't know, man, so many singers. We wanted someone that was really good. I mean, I've always loved bands with great singers, whether it be like, you know, Rainbow, you know, with Dio, or whether it be, you know, Iron Maiden, Bruce Dickinson, or, you know, Phil Mogg from UFO, or even like John Waite from the Babies. I mean, I liked the Babies when I was, I thought they were a really cool band, and that's such a great singer. So, but yeah, so we auditioned lots of singers, probably well over 30 or 40. And then we landed with the first singer of the band, a guy named Rob Bonston.
Yeah. Yeah. So getting the timeline right here. So you put out two demos and then the debut EP. So how do you recall the writing recording process of that first demo, which was 83?
I believe. 80. Yeah. The first demo. Yeah. We were just, those were songs that, probably two of them, two of them might have ended up on the album. I can't remember what was on that very first demo.
Yeah, we're talking how many years ago
now? Yeah, a long time. Yeah. But anyway, we did the first demo, and that was with singer Rob Bonston, and it was like something we started passing around. We started playing some pretty cool shows, man. We started playing, like, you know, with bands with, we played Exodus, we played with bands. Yeah. We played Dokken. We supported them. We supported
Slayer, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was that time we played with Slayer and Lars Rocket. Yeah, that was a great show. That was
Slayer's, if I could recall correctly, like their first ever Bay Area show.
Yeah, that was January of 84. And I came across a flyer for that a while ago. So yeah, that was cool. And Jeff, who was the manager of Lars Rocket at that time, he goes, "Yeah, you want your new band Ruffians to open up?" I'm all, "Yeah, let's do it." So we played open, Slayer played after us, and then Lars Rocket headlined the show. And yeah, this was the first time Slayer played Bay Area. And they had that makeup on, and it was sort of like, it was more of a kind of a Alice Cooper kind of eye makeup. They weren't being glammy or anything, but it was just sort of like a evil thing. And then, but you know, it was sort of, they were wearing like, you know, sort of leopardy print shirts with eye makeup, with, you know, the Kerry King's 4-inch roofing nails, whatever the hell he had. And so it was a little over the top, right? But they were from LA. And people and everybody in the Bay Area loved the music, you know, but they weren't too hip on the eye makeup and stuff like that, you know. You know, it's Bay Area, man. It's a hardcore crowd, and so they made it known. They're like, take the makeup off. And I think Andy Anderson, who was a friend of mine, he went to the bathroom to grab some like towels and was throwing them on stage. I don't remember seeing that happen, but so myth has it. But yeah,
I think that's mentioned in the documentary.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's great, man. That's cool that like you were kind of. It sounds like you were on good terms with Laz.
Yeah,
after Ruffians.
It was all good. Yeah, and those guys that were in that band, they remain, you know, some of my best friends, man.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what a crazy gig. What a weird, you know, Ruffians, Lars Rocket, Slayer.
Yeah, those were very sort of different. Like, those are legendary shows, man. And you'd play places. That was like at a place called Keystone Berkeley. And you know, it was really cool. Was there was a lot of neat clubs growing up around that time when we were growing up, And there was the old Waldorf, there was the Keystones, there was three of them, one in Berkeley, the Stone in San Francisco, and the Keystone Palo Alto. And then we had Ruthie's Inn, of course, too, which was like, you know, not as nice as those other clubs that I just mentioned. And like another really nice one was Wolfgang's. That was a club that Bill Graham had. And old Waldorf was a club that Bill Graham had. But
are any of these still around?
No, none of them are. But you know, they were proper venues, man, with backstage, and you know, they'd give you beer, they gave you water, and it was a pro stage. And like I said, you know, you'd get the chance to either headline these clubs, you know, which we were doing, or if, you know, Loudness or
Windio,
Y&T or bands like that would play, you know, you'd get to support it, you know, and it was really cool. There was another place that was really great that had some shows back then. It was called the Kabuki Theater in San Francisco. And that was in Japantown. And it was a step above those nightclubs that I mentioned because it was a more of a theater. And that place, the other clubs held like, you know, 500 people or something like that. But this place held like, I don't know, I'm going to say like, you know, maybe 1,000 people, 1,200 people, whatever. And then we started supporting bands there. And we supported, you know, Alcatraz, which was when Yngwie was in the band at the time. We supported Loudness there at the Kabuki. We supported Y&T. And it was fabulous, man. It was great. I mean, I remember we played with Loudness. And it was in 85. It was the Thunder in the East tour. And everybody was like, Akira, man, he's such an amazing guitar player. He's like the Eddie Van Halen of Japan, right?
Yeah.
And so we walked in the room and, you know, talked to the guys, and they didn't speak English very well. Mickey, the singer, he spoke, you know, the most English, and Minoru, the bass player, spoke a little bit of English. But we're hanging with them. I remember Kira Takasaki was like practicing from before their sound check to after their sound check, right up to the show. The guy's just sitting there, like, it's like, whoa, man, this guy is he gonna eat? He's just sitting there playing his guitar. Every time we walk by the room, he's just playing the guitar.
It's but very it really dedicated.
Cool. It was cool, man, like, because those are bands that you were hip to, like, that you liked. And it was really neat being able to support those bands and meet them and, you know, and to form relationships with them, you know.
That must have been, you know, you must have had so much motivation going into the recording studio, putting out, like, your first record, you know, being around all these amazing artists, you know, and playing with them. It must have really fueled, like, let's do this, let's put out something awesome. Now, I'm curious what your relationship was with Victory Records.
Yeah, so my sister, Lori, was managing Ruffians, right? She stepped in, and so she was totally behind us, man, and getting us all kinds of cool gigs. And we did the demo, and the demo was well received. We sent it all throughout Europe, man. People were trading the demo around. We're getting played on college radio. And she was like, okay, we need to do a record. I'm like, oh, wow, okay. You know, how we get signed to a label? And she goes, we're just going to do it ourselves. And that was a time where there was a lot of bands in that, during that time period, that were, you know, DIY bands, and they were putting out, you know, their own records or EPs or whatever they could afford to do. So we were one of those bands. So she goes, all right, I'm going to form Victory Records, and I'm going to send you guys in the recording studio, and you're going to record these songs off the demo, and, you know, new ones that, you know, that we had written. And so we had gotten, we recorded that in January of 85, and Carl Albert was the second singer for Ruffians. After the first guy left, Carl came in the band in 84, April of 84, because I know this because we had the gig opening up for Alcatraz, and we had that gig booked, and the first singer and the first bass player left the band. So we were just like high and dry, man, and we had this gig, at the Kabuki, and we're like, there's no way we're going to cancel it. My sister goes, don't cancel it. We're going to get another bass player. We're going to get another singer. So she goes, worst case scenario, we can cancel it at the last time, at the last minute or whatever. So anyhow, we had gotten Dan Mora, you know, because he wasn't the original bass player. And then Carl Albert came in and, you know, he was phenomenal. So going, you know, I'm just giving a little history. So we did, we go in to do the record with Carl, and that was at a place called Studio D in Sausalito in Marin. And so Lori says, all right, we're going to go to the studio, which is, I mean, this was one of the nicest studios in the Bay Area, man. It was like, this is where like Santana, Huey Lewis and the News.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of people, they did their albums there. And so she goes, we're going to do it there. We're all great. She goes, but you only got 24 hours.
Yeah.
So she goes, I could only afford to book the place for a 24 hour block. So we're okay. So she had gotten her friend, Paul Zoll, who played in a local band called SVT with Jack Cassidy from Jefferson Airplane. Paul was a drummer and Paul was pretty music savvy. And so he produced our album. She threw us in Studio D and we recorded the first album. And it was later released on Victory Records. I mean, yeah, man, it all happened fast.
Yeah, wow, 24 hours. So you guys just did not sleep. It was just constant. Your calluses were probably killing you by the next day. Just nonstop playing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what do you remember about being in the studio for 24 hours? How was it? How was the chemistry between everybody?
What I remember is like we're really psyched to do it, and it was a thing where we said that we were going to go from like, you know, let's do we'll go from like 12 noon to 12 midnight or something and whatever, or as long as we can go. So I remember arriving at the studio and probably around like, you know, 11 o'clock or something. And us bringing in all our gear in this room was just phenomenal, man. And Paul wanted to record there, as did my sister, because his bands had recorded there before, and they had incredible drum sound. So we just set up the drums, and I just remember these guys were getting drum tones forever, man. And we're all fired up. Like, when's our part come in, right? And when are we going to play the guitar? When's the band, like, play together? And so, boom, 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 boom. I'm learning about, like, oh, this is what it is to, like, really take your time and, like, try to do a record, you know, that's, like, you know, of high fidelity sound, an album or whatever, you know, want to do. So, so yeah, we're sitting, these guys are getting drum tones, man. I mean, it's like, you know, by the time the drums are set up, it's 1 o'clock. They're getting drum tones at four. and you know, never have a drummer produce your record.
Yeah. That's so funny.
But yeah, so we did. And so I remember he goes, okay, this is what you guys are going to do, man. You're going to rip through your songs. And you guys, you know, we're it's getting on late, so let's hurry up. We're like, it's getting kind of late. You've been doing drums. So we set up the guitars with our Marshalls, and the bass player's going like, I think he's got his amp, but he's going direct. And I'm playing through a direct signal through a Tom Scholz Rockman, one of those little headphone things that you used to play guitar through, right? Uh-huh. And it had this sort of light, chorus one and chorus two. Chorus one was kind of light, chorus two was kind of heavy. So I had it on chorus one. And so they go, this is going to be a ghost track. And then you guys will come do your rhythms in the control room afterwards. So we did it. And I remember those guys later on, like going, hey, that chorus sounds kind of cool. We'll kind of embed that into the track, you know? Which ended up being kind of cool. Listen back to it. Like, I thought it was a little bit too much chorus, but that was a sign of the times, you know, big drums, kind of chorus on guitars and stuff like that. But so yeah, we got through, man. We did all the tracks. We got the drum tracks down. We captured all the bass at the same time we did the drums. And the bass player had to come in and like maybe do like one or two fixes. Dan was phenomenal. Guy never made a mistake fucking hardly ever. And then, so we went to the control room, we banged out the rhythms, and we banged out the leads. It all happened really fast, man. We're recording on like 2-inch tape, so you had to like kind of nail it, you know. You could punch in a little bit here and there, but it was kind of play through the whole song, man, and don't fuck it up. And so we did that, and then we did our guitar solos, and that all happened pretty fast. And by this time, like, you know, by the time we're tracking, it's like I said, maybe 4 o'clock, and we're pretty much done tracking by like, you know, I don't know, man, like 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night. Cause I remember we went, it happened fast. We went and got like some pizza for dinner. And then that's about the time Carl was laying down his vocals. So I remember we're like, you know, eating pizza. He's laying down vocals by like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. And he's like in the control room. I remember he was going, man, this greasy pizza is really working for my voice. And Carl, he's like, just nailing it, right? And he's doing you know, he's a great singer, man. He was doing harmonies and stuff like that. And then after he did his vocals, we kind of came back and did a little bit more lead guitar just to play off of what the vocals were happening. And we went till about like, you know, till we dropped maybe like, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. And then it's like,
wow.
And then we tracked this with the album there. And then a few days later, we went to another place and we mixed it. And I think I did some acoustic guitar there or whatever. And then we went in another studio and mixed it in a day. But I remember like mixing the album was really cool because Paul, the producer, like he was sitting there and he'd play the song. And then the song would end. He would say, okay, when the song ends, I want you to sit there just zone out and just count, and then holler out the number that you hear before the next track would start. So you'd sit there, the track would end, it'd be like or like, you know, I hear it after 3 seconds or 4 seconds, and he would say, that's how we're gonna, you know, make the masters, so when they go cut the record, that will be the space between the songs that you've dictated, that you heard in your head. So it was kind of cool. Like, that's how you presented music back then. You presented it in the order that you wanted people to hear it. You know, side one starts off with a barn burner or something, and then there's, you know, the other tracks, and then side two starts off with like a barn burner and, you know, ends with a ballad or something, to, you know, how many seconds there are of silence between each track, you know, whereas now it's like, you know, I think everything's 2 seconds or something.
Yeah. Wow, man. That's great. It's so crazy how things have changed, you know, you know what I mean? Especially like you were talking tape and everything wild. Now how soon after all this did the physical release come out?
So we recorded the album, the first Ruffians album, that was January of 85. And then, you know, once we went, got it done, just I'll step back a little bit. Laurie took it down to have it mastered by Bernie Grundman in Los Angeles. And there's only a couple people back then that were mastering albums. There was Sterling Sound in New York. There was Bernie Grundman in LA. And then maybe two or three, like, you know, more in the country, you know. And if you look at back at these albums back in the day, it's usually Sterling Sound, Bernie Grundman. And so I wasn't there for the process, but Lori took it down, and she was saying how every time he would hear Bad Boys Cut Loose, the Ruffians track, he'd say, this always reminds me of White Punks on Dope, the Tube song, because they'd mastered that album. So anyway,
wow.
Lori came back with the mother tapes and then the mother discs. And then, yeah, we went and had it pressed, and it came out in May of 85. And we did it on our own label. Like I said, I think we had maybe like 3,500 copies made. I think it's something like that. And sent them out to all the radio stations. And then Lori had gotten the album licensed by SPV Records in Europe, I think probably later that year. And so that album was released. SPV was a pretty good label, man, back in Europe. So it was released all throughout Europe. And then she had had it released in Japan on another label called Far East Metal Syndicate, which Slayer was on.
Wow.
And some other metal bands. So then we had the album sort of, we'd licensed it out. We were in control of the album, man. We sent it. We got our money for the record, and we retained all our publishing. And it was a real lesson in how all this is done, you know, for me. And because Lori being my sister, I was kind of privy to kind of knowing how it was being handled, and she just wanted me to watch and learn, you know.
Yeah, so it definitely makes you like appreciate albums more, I feel, you know, knowing kind
what?
Of appreciate like albums.
Yeah,
and, like knowing how they're made, kind of like a look behind the curtain. It's like, oh, that's cool. You know,
yeah,
you listen to albums with like a new light now. That's interesting, and it's cool to like have that like with your sister, you know, and knowing everything that's going on. Now the record comes out. You know, what's the band's mindset in like the tail end of the '80s now?
Well, I mean, like, what's the band's mindset at the end of the '80s? Because well, the band started in 83 and then went to about like 88, I think, or something like that. So
yeah.
Our mindset right after we did the album or later?
Sure, yeah, the second half of the '80s.
Well,
so
mindset
right when the
album came out, and it was great, you know. We were playing around a lot, so we were on fire then, you know. And this is like, you know, 85, 86. And then 87, and you know, we kind of started plateauing around then, you know. And we didn't do another album or get an album deal, because we were playing, you know, we were playing heavy metal. We were playing like sort of power metal, which it wasn't really a term back then, but later on, you know, people refer to that as power metal. So thrash metal comes along, you know, around, I guess, you know, Exodus is the first thrash metal band. They were doing it, like their album came out after ours did in 85, that same year. And but then, you know, and Metallica is like, you know, I think Exodus and Metallica, I will say, this is the first thrash bands from the Bay Area. Then a lot of other bands kind of came, and then that's what the Bay Area is known for. And you know, we were kind of looking around trying to get a record deal, but there was really nothing happening for us that was of any substance that we'd want to, you know, do. And so we kind of plateaued. Still playing, still people, a lot of people come to the shows, playing Los Angeles, playing up here in the Bay Area. And then, the band ended up splitting up. I think it was sometime in 88, probably the latter part of 88.
Yeah.
We just kind of went our separate ways, and we all parted ways pretty much. Just like, hey, you know, we did this. And I think everybody wanted to kind of try different music, do different music, and go in different directions. And we all parted on great terms, and I'm still friends with all those guys to this day. But yeah, that's kind of what happened.
Yeah. And you joined Control after?
Yeah, after Ruffians. That was a band called Control. Now, don't get confused. There's two Controls. There's a Control earlier than us, with Doug Piercy, another Bay Area band. Doug Piercy from Anvil Chorus. And
Heathen.
Yeah, Heathen. And so and Thane, he played in Anvil Chorus too. But this band was a fun band. I did like a 180, and Control was a band that featured me on guitar. It was pretty much the brainchild of a guy named Phil Saunders, and he was a lead guitar player and songwriter. I played rhythm guitar, and Michael Coons from Lost Rocket sang vocals. And so it's very ancestral, the Bay Area, you know. And Mike was certainly came from a rock and roll background, and it was sort of a breath of fresh air for Mike to do something just straight up rock, you know, outside of Lost Rocket. And it was breath of fresh air for me to do it too. And Control's like kind of just straight up rock and roll AC/DC sounding band. And we started playing around in like 89 or so. And we made a dent in with the demos we did, and a lot of people came to see the shows. It was a cool band.
Yeah, very, very awesome. Is this out there for people to listen to, or was
Yeah.
it?
Well, it's the album was eventually released by a European label called what's the label called? Vinyl Got Soul or something like that. They only do vinyl.
Interesting.
And so I think there was like a real short, like 300 LPs, 300 or 500 LPs released in Europe of the Control album.
Yeah, interesting.
So, yeah, it's not on any music platforms, but we're working on that.
Cool. Exciting. Exciting,
Yeah.
man. Now, the 2000s, the age of the internet, we have people asking about Ruffians. The band gets invited to do the Bang Your Head Festival, I believe it's called. Were you hesitant about bringing the band back, or did you like want to just jump right into it?
Oh man, I was kind of blindsided by it, and a little hesitant, but it was such a prestigious festival and such a great offer, and that festival, along with some other festivals in Europe, but I think especially that one, is known for kind of resurrecting some bands from the past, that were popular in Europe, bands that have broken up and kind of getting them back together to play. So yeah, I was thought about it for a while, then I was all in. I said, let's do this. And I called Chris, the other guitar player. He wanted to do it. I called up Luke, he was in, and yeah, we got Rich, the singer. He was the third singer for Ruffians. He came after Carl. And yeah, we're all in, man. It was great. So we went over and did it. I would have never thought that the band was going to get back together. So but yeah, went over there. We did a warm-up show with Death Angel the night before, which is just amazing.
Awesome.
I mean, people were singing the songs. I couldn't believe it, and yeah, it was special. And then we played the festival the next day.
At what point were you like, maybe we should put out a second release?
Well, that we were over in Europe, when we went and did that festival, people were like, I can't believe you guys are here. We've been waiting so long to see you guys. And so this feedback that we're getting from everybody was just so positive. And it was it was I don't know, like revitalizing, and people had came up with the Ruffians album, and they're all signed by Carl. A lot of them on the back, but no other signatures because, Carl sang for Vicious Rumors and they would tour over there a lot. And so, and Carl passed on by that point. So they're like, I met Carl back then. And wow, I've been waiting for you guys to come and we're signing these records. So we're excited. And people kept asking, like, are you, you're here. Are you guys going to do another album? You're going to do another album. We're like thinking to ourselves, like, no, like we had done re-releases, building up, right around the same time that we did this, festival in 2004. And there's a label that we worked with called Hellion Records in Germany. They re-released the album with like live tracks and all sorts of different on vinyl, on CD. And so, yeah, we did that. We went back to Europe the next year, 2005, and we did a tour playing like five countries or so. And yeah, you guys gonna do another album. And then so we came back and we said, let's do it. So we released Desert of Tears was a full length album, 12 songs, in 2006.
Yeah, did you get 2 days of studio time for
Well,
that?
a little bit more than that, but not enough as I would have liked, as always, right? You gotta wrap it up, man. The label wants the record. So I feel pretty good about it. I think we got about like, maybe 90% there. It'd have been nice to have a little bit more time on it, but I'm happy with it.
Yeah, you mentioned before, I think you wanted more keys on it or
Yeah,
something.
more keyboards would have been cool. There's keys on a couple tracks, a track called Day of the Champion and a track called Freedom. And
Yeah.
the guy Phil Bennett played in Star plays in Jefferson Starship. Yeah, he plays keys on it. Great keyboard player. And it would have been cool to have more keys on it. I like that kind of stuff. It just adds a real cool texture.
Totally, 100%, man. How'd you get signed to Metal Heaven for that release?
Yeah, well, people, the word was out that we're going to do another album. And we wanted to give Hellion Records, who did us right with the re-releases, the first shot. And then we start talking to Metal Heaven. through our friend in Europe, Jürgen. He's sort of a like liaison for the band in Europe. He makes things happen for us. So he knew the Metal Heaven guys and said, hey, they want to talk to you. So they offered us more money, man, and they offered us tour support. So once I got the offer from them, I did go back to Hellion Records and say, hey, man, this is what they offered. Can you come close? Can you meet us? And he goes, I just can't. And so, because I want to stay loyal to them, man, you know? So then we went with Metal Heaven. And yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the modern day, if a festival ever offered, you know, a spot for Ruffians, would you take it? Or do you just kind of want to move on?
I mean, you know, it sounds flattering, you know, and yeah, I love the band, and I love the guys that were in the band with me. So I don't want to never say never, you know what I mean? But, you know, it would be probably slim to none. I don't know, man. We'll see.
Yeah, you've lived like five lifetimes, I feel.
Yeah.
Already.
But it's great playing over there and playing the festivals. I mean, a real highlight for me was like we were playing a warm-up show before a festival up in northern Germany. And the festival had like, you know, Raven was on it, Blitzkrieg, The Rods, and all these other cool bands. And so we played the warm-up show, and all the guys were at the warm-up show the night before, like hanging out, partying, right? And so you got Jess Cox, the first singer from Tigers of Pantang there. You got Brian Ross from Satan Blitzkrieg there. You got all the guys from The Rods and Jess Cox from Tigers of Pantang. We played, man, and the band sounded great that night. And they all came up to me afterwards. They go, hey, man, you know, you guys sounded really great, and can't wait to see you guys tomorrow. Because we were playing like, you know, that sort of music, that sort of the European hard rock metal, man, that what they were kind of doing, you know. So I think they dug us, and so that was a real highlight to hear that from all those guys, you know, bands that I listened to when I was younger, you know, and now we're hanging out with them and talking to them, and they're giving you accolades, you know.
Yeah, that must be amazing, man. The connections you have, you know, and it's like, you know, people call it a scene, but I feel like it was more of a movement. You know what I mean? Like so much, like the evolution of the genre, definitely like that's is a pinnacle point in it. Now, as someone who's a part of that, what's your opinion on where it's gone currently? Like what the genre of heavy metal is like evolved into?
You know, I got to be honest with you, man. I'm not sort of listening to a lot of new stuff, you know, that much. Kind of stuck in the 70s with some of my listening and heavy metal 80s.
Nothing but, wrong with that.
I know. But I think that there's stuff happening out there that I just don't know about, you know. I think there's a scene. As far as a movement, maybe not as much, you know. But you know, I mean, there's a band, local band called Hellfire, and yeah, you should check them out. And they're really like, you know, and they're really holding the torch to, you know, carrying the torch of like this, you know, heavy metal, cool guitar harmonies and sort of thrash metal, but not too thrash. And they're out, they went out and supported, like Death Angel on a US tour. And so there's a lot of decent, there's a band called Haunt. I've heard a couple of tunes from. They're a band from Bay Area. So there's a scene going on. There's stuff happening, man. You know, it's just that it's their time, you know?
Yeah. Awesome. Very cool to hear. Well, thanks for talking to me, man. This has been a pretty awesome conversation. Really.
Yeah,
appreciate
man.
It.
Well, thanks for having me, Brandon. It's really nice talking to you as well.
What's the best way for fans to stay updated with everything you're doing?
Well, right now, I'm playing, I have a band called The Butlers, and we play cover tunes. It's just a fun thing with a bunch of different guys who have been in different bands over the years. And if you go to butlerssf.com, You can check that out. And we play throughout the Bay Area. We have some shows coming up here in the next few months. And then I'm also playing with Handsome Dick Manitoba, who was in The Dictators. And they are a band, you know, classic band from mid-70s, from New York scene, that whole CBGB scene.
Boss,
you know?
The Boss, yeah.
Yeah. So Handsome Dick Manitoba were out. Me and Michael Butler, who plays bass in the Butlers, are in his band with some other great guys. And yeah, we've been doing some tours. We just did California, and then we did East Coast tour. And so that's been a lot of fun, man. It's really great. Those are it's great backing him up and playing those songs. I mean, they're such great songs. So that's what I'm doing now.
Very, very exciting, man. Hope to see you at some point. You know, you were in New England recently.
Yeah, we missed each other. Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Well, if you do a Texas run, you know, I'll
Well,
be
I
there.
I think we're doing the Texas run with Handsome Dick Manitoba in May.
Amazing.
Yeah, so I know that we'll do all the hot spots. We'll do Austin, we'll do Dallas, we'll do Houston. So are you going to be in Texas then?
I'll be in Austin in February.
Okay, well, cool, man. Well, there's a good chance we'll see each other in May.
Yeah, I'm going to make sure. Never again.
Yeah.
You're in my backyard, you know?
Yeah.
Well, this has been awesome, man. I'm Brandon Baddock, and this is Disturbing the Priest.